Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Ain't no Friday like a Jobs Day Friday, am I right? From American Public Media, yes, I am right. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, as I said, the fourth day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We've got jobs today, of course. We got the Fed this week. Of course. So on this Friday, we've got Gina Smilek from The New York Times and Amara Omokwe from The Wall Street Journal. Also, of course. Hey, you two.
Hello. Hi.
So, Amara, let me ask you this. Jobs today, 261,000 new jobs in this economy in October. The rate bumps up a little bit to 3.7%. We can talk about why. The gist, though, is that this is not a labor market that's doing the Federal Reserve any favors, right?
Nope, no favors at all. I mean, what the jobs report shows us is that the labor market is slowing somewhat, but that it still, on the whole, remains on pretty solid ground. We did see the number of jobs added slow down from September, mm-hmm. and certainly the number is down from earlier this year, but still beat economists' expectations. The unemployment rate, as you mentioned, ticked up, but it's still really low. And when we look even more broadly than that, there's still a lot of signs of tightness, right? We know that the number of job openings is still way above the number mm-hmm. of available workers. We saw labor force participation come down. That means we're not seeing more workers come into the labor force. And so what you saw a lot of economists saying today is that the labor market is still in a strong enough position that it continues to pose a challenge for the Fed as it works to get inflation down.
Okay, so Gina, look, Jay Powell and his colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee have done everything except, like choke off the blood supply to the American labor market, if I can mix my metaphors, right? And it's still really strong. Why?
I think part of it is that it takes a little while for monetary policy to sort of work its way through the system and really cool down the economy. So what we do know is that we've seen this pullback in the housing market, and you can see that in these jobs mm-hmm. numbers. You're seeing some slowing in those construction numbers, those sort of housing sensitive sectors. It's just clearly going to be a bit of a heavy lift and a bit of a long road to get that kind of broader slowing that you expect in a rate hiking cycle. I think the Fed was hoping that the fact that it started signaling that it was going to pull back support last year and that it started pulling back that support in March was going to kind of play through the economy relatively quickly. And I'm just not sure that we're getting that at this stage.
And yet, the Fed chair says it would be premature really to think about us slowing down or pivoting or anything. And let's in fact talk about rates going higher for longer.
Yeah, I mean, the Fed Chair Powell at his press conference this week, I mean, I think he was pretty clear that the Fed is committed to staying on this path of raising interest rates until they are more satisfied that inflation is getting under control. And he kind of sounded kind of sort of pessimistic about where we are. You know, he basically said, you know, when you think about the last year, we haven't really made that much progress. And he again sort of reiterated that they feel like the risks of doing too little far outweigh the risks of doing too much, and that in the event that they do end up somehow over-tightening, he feels like their tools can sort of inject some support for the economy at that point. So yeah, very, very much committed to staying on this path.
Gina, Powell talked a bit anyway on Wednesday about inflation expectations, about which you wrote this morning. And I want you to help folks understand why what we are thinking, how we are feeling about inflation and what we're expecting for inflation matters.
Right. So we understand so little about how inflation actually works.
Say that again. That's really, really important. That's really important.
We don't get inflation. We really don't get it. We do not understand it. We don't know how to predict it. We don't know why it stays high when it goes high. We know that it does tend to stay high when it goes high. And one of the reasons that economists think that might be the case is when you're looking around at all the prices that of all the things you buy on a regular basis climbing, that's how you're thinking about how you like are going to ask for a wage increase this year. You know, when you're setting your salary expectations for 2023, it's It's going to be based on the inflation that you're experiencing right now. The issue with that, obviously, is if your employer gives you, you know, an 8% raise matching the CPI next year, your employer is also going to try and raise prices by 8% so that they're not taking a hit to their bottom line. And so the issue here is that those sort of short-term expectations, those that sort of, you know, reaction to where inflation is now could actually make inflation a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy where it keeps itself sort of perpetuated. And I think that's what the Fed is getting increasingly wary of. Chair Powell talked about it this week. He basically said what I just said. We don't understand inflation. Yeah, and so this is why they're very worried about keeping an eye on this and getting it under control pretty quickly.
Can we talk, Amara, about companies and corporations and their role in this? Because as Gene alluded to, right, companies have been raising prices and taking advantage of this moment in inflation to increase their profits. And that's leading some, a lot of people on the American left to say, ho, 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 this is all about corporate America.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And I think this is an ongoing debate. I don't think there's consensus among economists that, you know, price gouging or profiteering is what is sort of driving the inflation that we're seeing. But you definitely do see this debate happening in Washington. You see a lot of lawmakers on the left sort of putting blame at the feet of corporations. You hear the president talking about sort of encouraging energy companies to pass on some of these profits in the form of savings to consumers. So it's just an ongoing debate that is especially ramping up with these midterm elections approaching and so many voters thinking about how inflation is affecting their lives.
Last question on the Fed, Gene. In fact, last question of the day, because we got to go. I want to talk for a second about the 1970s and Volcker, and not the question I usually throw to you because you're writing a book on the Fed and history. But I want, you know, and it's widely acknowledged that the Fed, you know, Neil Kashkari at the Minneapolis Fed said this to me. We were basically traumatized, he said, the Fed is, by the 1970s and what happened there. Why do you think the Fed is so... what's the word for Powell? I mean, he's bound and determined to take care of inflation almost no matter what happens. And I want your sense of why.
Yeah, I think it does tie back to that Volcker experience. I think when you think about that sort of 1981, 1982 period, they raised interest rates to 20%. They pushed unemployment to above 10%. You know, I think it's so important to think about what that means. It means one out of 10 people was basically incapable of finding jobs. Like that is such a big number. And I think that that trauma, that sort of knowledge that the Fed did that, like the Fed made a choice to throw so many people out of work and it was necessary, they think, to bring inflation down. Nobody wants to repeat that. Nobody wants to be the person who lets inflation get so bad that you have to inflict that kind of pain on the American economy in order to wrestle it back under control. And so I think the reason they're so resolute now is they think they're not at a stage where it's going to be that awful to get inflation under control, but they don't want to get to that point.
Yeah, that's a good word, resolute. Gina Smilek, The New York Times, Amara Mokwe at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Ed.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street Today, you know, I knew a stockbroker once who liked to say he was looking for a reason to buy. Well, they were looking for a reason to buy on Wall Street Today. I'll tell you that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The monthly jobs report is, of course, just a whole lot of data points. One of those data points that's more relevant than most of the others is what's known as average hourly earnings, which have been moving pretty steadily up all year long. I don't know this for a fact, but I would guess that Jay Powell and the rest of them are watching that pretty closely because wage growth can sometimes, the operative words being can and sometimes, drive inflation. In his press conference this week, Powell did say that wage gains have been well above, that's his word, where they need to be to get inflation down to where the Fed wants it to be, which is, of course, 2%, give or take. Now, set aside for a second the argument that workers need and should have higher pay in an inflationary environment. That just kind of stands to reason. But this morning's job report showed those wage gains moderating, which maybe is just what the Fed's looking for. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Wages were up 4.7% year over year in October, down from 5% the month before. And, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute,
if you look last month compared to the 3 months prior, wage growth has been decelerating, certainly moderating, and appears to be decelerating over the last few months.
That's evidence the Fed's interest rate hikes are taking some heat out of the job market, says Kurt Long at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions.
We're seeing less job churn. People are quitting their jobs at slightly lower rates than they were previously. Employers are not having to work quite so hard to keep current staff on their payrolls.
That means offering pay raises is less urgent than it was earlier in the year. All well and good, but Fed Chair Powell said this week he wants to see wage growth fall to a level consistent with 2% inflation. Wage growth certainly isn't that low yet, but Elise Gould says it doesn't have to be.
We want to have wage growth that at least exceeds inflation so that people have increase in their living standards, increases in their ability to make ends meet. And we also want workers to see the returns of their increased productivity. Over the long term, we see productivity growth around 1.5%.
Meaning, if the Fed could get wage growth down to around 3.5%, that might be good enough to fight inflation. And Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union says there's no reason to think we need wage growth to be any lower right now.
Wage increases at this moment are an absolute good. They're helping Americans keep up with inflation, at least to some extent, and they're not contributing to inflation.
Frick's authority for that last item is the Fed chair himself, who said earlier this week, we want wages to go up, just not so much that they spark a wage price spiral. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The spectacle that is Twitter at the end of week one of Elon Musk's tenure just keeps on spectacling. Corporate offices were closed today, actually, because something like half of the company is being laid off. That news tidbit you've surely heard already, but we want to talk about the how of it. Because Twitter employees were sent a detailed memo about how things would go today. They were told to stay home, first of all, and wait for an email that would tell them their fate. If you get an email to your work address, you're good. If it comes to your personal address, gather your belongings, which is honestly a really rough way to tell 3,500 people that they're out of a job. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has the art and the science of the mass layoff.
Layoffs are one of those things that feel so terrible that there's no good way to do them. But there are definitely bad ways and better ways. Jason Windmill at Argo Point, a management consulting firm, says giving employees a written heads up that layoffs are coming is common.
It should communicate, here's the process, here's some of the milestones. And that can be helpful in letting some people know about things.
It gives employees time to mentally prepare, and it clarifies any rumors circling the office. In the meantime, a team of people, mostly executives, HR, and legal, are busy planning how the layoffs will be communicated. Michael Sturman, a professor of human resources management at Rutgers University, says the biggest point of discussion is exactly what will be said.
Sometimes even down to the point where a script needs to be made ahead of time.
He says it's important to keep the message short but empathetic, and the details should be specific. Communicate what resources employees are entitled to and the reasons people are being laid off. For instance, maybe the company is making a big strategy shift that affects a certain department. The next decision is how the news will be delivered. And big surprise, Sturman says, it probably shouldn't happen over email.
It's like breaking up in a relationship by text.
Instead, he says companies should take the time for one-on-one meetings in person or over Zoom, even if that means doing thousands of them. It creates space for conversations and questions, a two-way street. Plus, the way all layoffs are communicated sends a strong message to the employees who are sticking around. Kai-Feng Jiang is a professor of management at The Ohio State University.
So if they feel this whole layoff process is fair, they feel more safe.
And if the remaining employees feel safe, that may help with morale. Jiang says if those aren't enough reasons for companies to show employees they care, there are always the business reasons, how consumers and shareholders might react. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I was looking through a roll-off dumpster that was outside the building.
One person's trash is another person's treasure. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 401 today. 1 2/10% finished at 32,403. The NASDAQ lifted 132 points. That's 1 3/10%. 10,475. The S&P 500 found 50 points. 1 3/10%. Landed at 37.70. For the week, the Dow off 1.4%. The NASDAQ down 5 6/10%. S&P 500 down 3 3/10%. We heard from Kristen Schwab about how companies have to think about layoffs. Well, other tech companies besides Twitter have been facing that. You know, Lyft lifted 0.1% today. Meta rose 2 1/10%. Snap down 2/10% today. As candy buckets are still being surreptitiously emptied in households across the country, yes, I'm raising my hand. The Hershey Company released better-than-expected third-quarter earnings. Hershey, nonetheless, softened 1 3/10%. Mondelez International, you might know that better as Kraft, even though the name change has been done for a while, rose 1 9/10%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.16%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. According to YouTube, more than 500 hours of content are uploaded to that site every single minute of every single day. So some of that content, just on the law of averages, is going to run afoul of some law or another. And often that law is copyright law. Instead of hiring tens of thousands of people to manually check all that uploaded content for copyright infringement, YouTube has come up with a technical solution. It's called Content ID that checks for copyrighted material, including music, on the site. And that has created some friction between YouTubers who create content to teach people how to play musical instruments and independent musicians. Marketplace's Peter Balanon-Rosen dug into that.
Hop onto YouTube to learn how to play guitar, and you'll hear a lot of this.
If you're a beginner metal guitar player, then this video is for you.
All right, guys, in this video, I'm going to show you five famous riffs that are
actually... Here's 10 solos that aren't very difficult to play.
Scratch the surface of these channels, and you'll hear folks riffing on something else.
Music publishers to agree to release their copyright strikes on my videos.
Algorithm and the Content ID.
YouTube's copyright rules.
That last voice belongs to Rob Jones. He runs the YouTube channel The Guitar Manifesto, where he reviews and builds guitars and demos famous riffs. He says in recent years, Content ID has flagged a slew of his videos on behalf of major labels, even though he's playing the riffs himself.
Literally playing riffs, yeah. I could play 10 seconds, I could play 30 seconds, not even with any background music, just a guitar on its own.
Jones has over 20,000 followers and makes money from his channel. But when YouTube flags one of his videos, copyright holders, generally record labels, have a choice. Take his video down, or divert the revenue it generates to themselves, so he earns nothing.
I did a bass guitar review, and I played Africa by Toto. Just a little do-do-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, then the video got demonetized.
Now, Content ID doesn't flag every check-out-this-riff video. There are still plenty online. But last year, YouTube videos caught the system's attention 1.5 billion times.
Content ID is incredibly powerful. It can run around YouTube and claim a whole bunch of stuff real quick. I'm talking within seconds.
Ryan Bosak says that's a good thing. He heads up SuperBAM, which helps clients find their copyrighted material on YouTube and monetize it using Content ID. He says the system helps copyright owners reclaim what's rightfully theirs. Last year, they used Content ID to claim $2 billion in revenue.
You're talking a whole lot of money. It's a big business. It's a meaningful business.
Now, the automated system has come under fire for inappropriately flagging birds singing, loops of a cat purring. A few years back, a news channel uploaded a recording of a NASA mission generating claims against other channels, including NASA itself. But Bosak says Content ID is important.
There's thousands of videos uploaded to YouTube every minute, right? A lot of those pieces of content contain some level of content piracy.
But Content ID doesn't treat all artists equally.
People like me who want to use it to protect our music were, it seems, very left out.
Maria Schneider is a musician who's kind of done it all. 7 Grammys, collaborations with David Bowie, a Pulitzer nomination. And her music is all over YouTube for free.
At the same time, I'm trying to sell music, sell a record on my own website. It's impossible to compete with free.
YouTube limits access to Content ID to about 9,000 movie studios, record labels, and publishers, whose material the platform says is most likely to be used without permission. Or, as YouTube puts it, folks who own today's hit song, scenes from a new movie, or the latest viral video. And Schneider isn't one of them. She's applied to use Content ID twice and been denied. She can manually report infringement, but she says that's not enough. So she's heading up a class action lawsuit that claims YouTube facilitates mass copyright infringement by limiting access to Content ID to only the most powerful copyright owners.
If we had the tools to properly protect ourselves from that free-for-all marketplace, it would be a game changer for us.
In a statement, YouTube says it's working to expand access while balancing the need to protect creators and other rights holders. The platform says it also offers other tools to protect copyrights and that content creators always have the right to dispute claims against them. I'm Peter Balanon Rosen for Marketplace.
Our stories from Buffalo this week have been street level, right? Looking at what's going on the ground where prices and inflation have been a steady theme. Today, one example of where the price of goods at retail doesn't really matter all that much.
My name is Aaron Sheffield.
My name is Dave Sheffield.
I'm a front desk coordinator.
I own a small manufacturing business in Buffalo, New York.
Dave and I met, it was like 13 years ago now. I was headed to a local university to dumpster dive.
I was looking through a roll-off dumpster that was outside the building.
I recognized what he was doing right away, but I thought, why don't I just kind of joke around with him? So I said, like, hey, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm dumpster diving. And kind of just gave me like an honest answer. And I was like, don't worry, I'm doing it too.
Gave her a ride to the next dumpster.
We just bonded right away.
And the rest is history.
I'll usually go like 2 or 3 times per week on his dumpster route.
We've kind of taken it to the next level the last few years. We can make $1,000 to $3,000-$4,000 a month. It could be really random stuff, obscure machine parts, but then it could be bike helmets and tires that were brand new, and we're able to list those for $40 and $80.
Right now, we're looking to save up from dumpster diving because we want to convert, it's just kind of a room downstairs into a bathroom.
We might splurge a little bit by putting a steam shower in. It's nice in these cold Buffalo winters. We're going dumpster diving.
We'd love to dumpster dive as a couple because it's a lot of fun. We never know what we're going to find.
And we'll hit probably two or three different big commercial plazas. We kind of know it by heart by now.
Oh, this is a mat for like an office mat for a chair. And we can, I mean, something like this we could probably take and sell. Or we could use ourselves. So we're definitely taking this.
That's the beauty of dumpster diving. Anything that they sell in the store, you might find in this dumpster. So it could be ink cartridges, it could be paper. I've found the desk chairs and put them together and then sell them on Facebook Marketplace for $80, $100. So
we got them for free, so that's kind of the beauty of it, is when you get it for free, you don't mind selling it. And especially now with like inflation, extra cost of goods, people are looking for a deal, so that drives more business to us because we can sell it at a lower price.
You can tell that they're clearing out inventory, so now it's worth it to dig a little deeper and see what else we can find.
When people ask us what's the best thing you ever found in the dumpster, I always say it's my husband.
Aaron and Dave Sheffield, they're living, working, and dumpster diving in Buffalo, New York. This final note on the way out today, we started our Buffalo week on Monday, if you remember, talking to ADP chief economist Neela Richardson about that city as a story of economic hope. Well, here's an indicator of that hope that we didn't really get to spend too much time on this week, but in the months of reporting we did for this project, it just kept coming up.
The Buffalo Bills.
I'm actually wearing a Bills shirt.
The Bills colors.
The Buffalo Bills impeccable season.
If you're a Bills fan, everybody would just like circle around you.
We about to put our flag out here. Go Bills! What? Mike McKenzie? That's his name, right?
Isaiah
McKenzie. Excuse me, Mr. McKenzie. Yeah, go get that.
Bills are 6-1 this year. Top of the AFC. Jets on Sunday. All right, off we go. This is your moment of economic context, another data point from today's jobs report that I do try to keep an eye on. So the overall unemployment rate was, as we were talking about earlier, 3.7% last month. The white unemployment rate, 3.2%. For black Americans, 5.9%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.